My daddy has lots of books, and he likes to read books. And he interviews authors at KAZI. You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
Welcome to KAZI Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. On KAZI Book Review, we'll be featuring the 4th Annual Celebration of Diverse Literary Voices, the Focus on Fiction event, which occurred on June 13, 2020, on Zoom. The authors featured are Nikki Drayton, Mon Jen, Rion Amakar Scott, and Richard Z. Santos. Dion Schaffner, a student at the time in the Austin Community College Creative Writing Department, offered the introductions.
I'm Dion Schaffner. I'm a student in the ACC Creative Writing Department. I highly recommend it, checking it out if you haven't before. Now, more than ever, our communities are recognizing not just the need, but the importance of diversity in every facet of our lives. The collective strength of the fabric of humanity benefits from the interwoven threads of experiences, perspectives, creativity, and understanding of your voices. I'm excited to be a part of celebrating diverse literary voices, and I'm proud to introduce the members of today's panel. To start, we have Richard Santos, whose Trust Me is his debut novel. He's currently seeking representation for his second novel, Every Family is a Conspiracy Theory. He is a board member of the National Book Critics Circle and served as a nonfiction judge for the 2019 Kirkus Prize. He's also an associate editor for American Short Fiction. Before becoming a writer and a teacher, Richard lived in Washington, D.C. and worked for some of the nation's top campaigns, political consulting firms, and labor unions. Richard has an MFA from Texas State University, go Bobcats, and taught at Texas State, Georgetown University, and the University of District of Columbia. Please welcome Richard Santos. Richard. Next, we have Mon Jen. She is the author of the novel Little Gods, a Kundiman Fellow. Her short fiction is forthcoming in Best American Short Stories 2020 and the Pushcart Prize Anthology of 2021. She currently lives in San Francisco and is up very early for this event. So thank you, Mon, for getting up first. We also today have Rion Amakar Scott. He is the author of the story collection, The World Doesn't Require You, a finalist for the Penn and Jean Stein Book Award. He was raised in Silver Spring, Maryland, and earned an MFA from George Mason University, where he won the Mary Robert Reinhart Award, a Completion Fellowship, and an Alumni Exemplar Award. He has received fellowships from Breadloaf Writing Conference, Kimbelow, and the Colgate Writing Conference, as well as the 2019 Maryland Individual Artist Award. His works have been awarded numerous awards and have been published in journals such as The New Yorker, The Kenyon Review, Crab Orchard Review, and The Rumpus, among others. Presently, he teaches creative writing at the University of Maryland. And finally, we have Nikki Drayton. She is a systems analyst who dabbles in prose when she's not buried in code. She resides in Austin, Texas, where being weird is highly encouraged, if not required. Her award-winning novel, The Prey of Gods, is set in a futuristic South Africa brimming with demigods, robots, and hallucinogenic hijinks. And with her new novel, Escaping Exodus, she'll be taking her weirdness off-world to a civilization living inside the gut of a moon-sized space beast. Please welcome all our panelists today.
All right. I've asked each of the panelists to read an excerpt from their book before we get started. So I'm actually looking at my screen and I'm going to go left to right. So Nikki, you are first on the screen.
I'm just going to read a little bit of my story that takes place inside of a giant spacefaring beast. And there are people who work inside the various organs. So this is the people working inside the heart. Amma herds me along with a handful of recruits through the dark, dank twists of the rerouted arteries. It smells heavily of ichor in here, the floor still slick with its oily blue-green residue. I mind the countdown timer entwined with my soul, trying to keep step with a steady rhythm. Beat, one of the other recruiters yells, a whole 15 seconds too early. So early she nearly throws me off my own count. She's nervous now. We all are. 3 beats ago, another of the recruits had been late. The heart mothers had held the girl down, and one by one, they cut the girl's braids from her scalp. I'd stood there watching in horror as her identity was ripped from her, her history erased. For hundreds of years, that same pattern had been braided upon her ancestors' heads, representing the constellations we'd drawn in the sky, our people traveling freely among the stars. All these centuries later, our sky has changed, but those braided patterns hadn't, and now it would stop with her. The girl's own Amma had sobbed and wept, watching her family line come to an end.
Thank you, Nikki. Now, we'll go next to Mon Jin, author of Little Gods.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me, Hopeton and Dion, for that wonderful intro. I'm just going to read the first two paragraphs of my novel, Little Gods. And it starts on the night of June 3rd, 1989, which is the end of the Tiananmen Square protests, democracy protests in Beijing. From above, the heart of the city is easy to see. Beijing is a bullseye. Concentric ring roads close in toward the old city walls, now paved into wide avenues. The avenues form a tight band around the heart, the south-facing gates, the moated palace, the desert square. On a map, diminishing circles draw in the eye as if to say, come. Bodies have come. In the square, bodies sit, stand, and lie on the hot paved stone. The square was built for 600,000 bodies. For weeks, there have been more. Rats sniff between folds of newspaper, flies regurgitate on sunburned shins, roaches scuttle across sleeping toes. Women in white uniforms weave through carrying metal tanks, spraying disinfectant where concrete shows. From above, this movement looks like a primitive organism breathing. In the nucleus, a burst of color radiates and contracts as bodies leave the square, return and leave again. West of the outer ring, a dark mass gathers. Troops preparing to enter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mon. Next, we will go to on my screen, Rion.
Hi. So I'm going to read a little bit from my story collection, The World Doesn't Require You. This is a story that's called The Nigger Knockers. I need to do a little bit of setting up. What most people call ding-dong ditching, that's what we called it as kids, nigger knocking, for whatever reason. I don't know why. But I wrote a story which takes place in my fictional town called Cross River, in which a guy is writing a dissertation to try to understand where that comes from. And then he goes over to the next town, Port Yuga, which used to be it's another fictional town of mine, which used to be a sundown town, which if you don't know, it had a racist history basically. And they start knocking on doors to try to get some practical experience to write into their dissertation. And this is how their knocking experiment ended. But what ended it all was something that happened on a day we couldn't go out. A Wednesday. I had to work late and Tyrone said he was meeting with his dissertation advisor, but I think he really wanted to see Zoe. I would finally have time to sit and write a little something of my own, I thought. Easter just passed and everything from the grass to the buds on the dogwood trees was in midst of rebirth. As the Days and Times described it, a teenager named Emmanuel Richardson, a member of the only black family in the neighborhood, stood outside his house in Port Yuga late one evening ringing the bell for dear life. He had forgotten his keys that morning and asked his mother, Cynthia Richardson, to stay up when he came home from his job at the grocery store. She tried gallantly, but she had worked a full day herself and fell asleep right there on the living room couch. Emmanuel could see a bit of her through the window. He looked to his cell phone, but his battery had died on the walk home. Annoyed and tired, he placed his backpack on the ground to ease the weight behind him. Almost as soon as he started to bang, Emmanuel heard shouting. He turned slowly to see five men approaching. He recognized them as his neighbors, and the tension eased. Mr. Thomas, Emmanuel said, can I use your... Don't move, kid, Mr. Thomas shouted. He looked at Emmanuel with no recognition, even though Emmanuel had lived in the neighborhood for each one of his 16 years. He played with Mr. Thomas's kids. Once he washed his neighbor's car for extra cash and ended up scratching it. Mr. Pickering's pink Pontiac. Now his neighbors watched him with stone eyes. Their faces glowed blue beneath the porch light. Their mouths grew animated in rage and vulgarity. In the newspaper, the three neighbors who offered comment, Mr. Pickering among them, said they had never seen Emmanuel before. Emmanuel's neighbors marched on him, petitioners protesting his existence. Emmanuel ran. For his life, Emmanuel ran. Left his bag right there on his porch, and Emmanuel ran through the streets as the men chased. "Help me," he cried. "Someone please help me." He stopped to knock on doors, but the men were right there at his heels, forcing him each time to abandon that door. His knocks at some houses caused more people to come outside and join the mob. Emmanuel dipped across lawns, backyards, and through carports. It wasn't long before one of the men caught him with a forearm to the neck. Emmanuel's head hit the concrete. They kicked and punched him as he covered his face. More neighbors arrived, raining more blows. Reading all about it, I wondered if poor Emmanuel thought they would take him right there to the hanging tree. The police, his salvation for the night, showed up well into the beating and arrested him, charging him with attempted robbery, breaking and entering, battery, and criminal mischief. Unfortunately for Emmanuel, he needed the hospital far more than he needed the police station, and when his mother finally got him into a hospital bed, he was in bad shape indeed.
Oh, thank you, Rian. So I do want to start off to have our authors talk a bit about their novels, and I'm actually going to start here with Richard Santos, who actually has not had a chance to read his excerpt. Richard, I was actually about to forget to give you an opportunity to read your excerpt, Richard. I apologize.
That's okay.
Good thing this isn't live TV, right? All right, so go ahead, Richard, if you could go ahead and read an excerpt from your novel, Trust Me.
Okay. I'm going to read a page or so from the second chapter. It's the first time this character is introduced. Hell of a week for Gabriel Luna. First, he was fired from a job he hated. Then he discovered his mean bastard of a father gave him bone cancer. Driving a dump truck on San Miguel Pueblo did not pay well, but it did pay. Gabe was helping to build Santa Fe's first major airport, and although the dust gave him headaches and he hated the hours and the heat, he occasionally felt something close to pride in the work. Then a bulldozer dug up a skeleton where there was not supposed to be a skeleton, and the whole site went to shit. A man with shiny shoes climbed onto the bed of a truck and, with shaking hands clasped in front of his mouth, sent everyone home. Gabe and the other laborers were given vague corporate assurances that the site would reopen after a swift investigation into the origin of the artifacts. He wasn't holding his breath. Holding his breath might be better, though, than letting the bone cancer tunnel through his body. The same cancer had worn his father down to nothing but pain and sweat. Gabe would not go out that way. The diagnosis came from Shaman Jeff, whom Gabe called Jefe. Wearing his customary blue Halliburton cap and smoking a cigarette, Jeff had said, "Yep, that's cancer, to the core. Can damn near see it dripping from your nose." Gabe imagined his dying old man spitting bone cancer cells like pollen spores, special delivery, aimed right at the son who was never there. Granted, no actual doctor had diagnosed him. Jefe's diagnosis came after poking a few lymph nodes and lighting a candle. But in 15 years, he had never steered Gabe wrong. The cancer was chewing on Gabe's bones, that was for sure. Now, a couple weeks after that 1-2 punch, Gabe pulled up in front of Jefe's trailer and killed his bike. Time for his second treatment. Thank you. Thank you, Hopton, Charlotte, everybody.
Thank you. I do want to say that I've read all the books here, and I love all the books that I've read. And I don't say that because this is all being public. One of the great things about doing KZR Book Review is since I do that show as a volunteer, I make the decision that I'm going to select books that I really want to read, that I think are very, very important books and or very entertaining books. So I do want to say that. And I want to go back to you, Richard, because I thought what was interesting about your book, which is about drug dealing, corruption, power and land rights, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. So you have three main narrators. So you read from Gabe, who's kind of down on his luck. He's working at this airport development site, and he actually finds the skeleton that moves the plot forward. We also have Charles O'Connor, who's a political operative, down on his luck, and has moved from Washington, D.C. to Santa Fe because he is unhirable. And we have Olivia Branch. She is the wife of Cody Branch, the multimillionaire developer building the airport, who wants to divorce Cody. So we have three characters that are kind of in situations where they're really looking to get either make a comeback, in the case of Gabe, make enough money to show his ex-wife that he's responsible enough to spend more time with his son, or with Olivia, who just wants to get a better agreement than what she agreed to with her prenuptial agreement. So why don't you set the stage for our participants in the Zoom meeting here about that Santa Fe environment that you've created.
Yeah. Santa Fe is an interesting place. New Mexico is a very strange and interesting place. My mom's family is from there. I've spent a lot of time there. And when I started to put together the notes for what this novel would become, I was setting myself a big task of trying to like wrap my arms around the complexity, centuries and centuries of history, really complex racial dynamics. It's a state where for hundreds and hundreds of years, people have been moving back and forth across it, usually just through it, taking what they need and leaving lots of like wreckage behind them. Everything from the Spanish conquistadors to the Americans doing the atomic bomb tests to oil today and so on. I think that I also wanted to write a book where a bunch of characters were in a series of bad situations and they kept making it worse for themselves and then had to pull themselves back out, you know, because like you said, it's kind of a book about people trying to build an airport. And it's kind of a book about like a dude who doesn't know what else to do with himself. So he tries to like sell some drugs that he shouldn't be selling. But really it's about the power dynamics that put these people in these situations to begin with. And as they start being pitted against each other, it's really none of their faults. It's the fault of this sort of like larger context that they find themselves in.
Now, Nikki, I want to talk to you a little bit about the society that you have created in Escaping Exodus. It's Afrofuturistic novel, science fiction. It's about 1,000 years into the future. And I think with the title Escaping Exodus, sort of the biblical references there. But this is a matriarchal and matrilineal society with the main characters being Seska and Adala, who are also from different classes. So you sort of turn the world on its head, matriarchal, matrilineal, and then you bring the class issues into play. And to top all this off, they are living in a beast with hearts and other things. Now, my daughter wants to be a doctor, so she might be interested in reading your novel just to learn about the inside of a beast and preparation to be a doctor. But talk a little bit about creating a matriarchal, matrilineal society 1,000 years into the future that is, they live inside of an actual sentient being.
Okay. Well, with this book, I had a lot of fun playing with a lot of different elements. One of them was to play with kind of to mirror our own world and what we're doing with our own environment. And so in this story, humanity has escaped Earth, and there was like some cataclysmic event a long time ago. And now they've been able to find a place for themselves. Instead of finding a new planet, they found these giant moon-sized beasts that they can live inside the body, and they could like kind of mine it for resources. And that whole process of mining the entire beast and using up all the resources takes about like 10 to 15 years. And then they move on to the next beast. There's like a big herd of them in space that they kind of follow along. And so it kind of mirrors what, you know, we're doing to our Earth and like using up all the resources there. And there's also a very big class component to this story. Everything is matriarchal, this matrilineal existence, which, you know, some people might call it like a feminist story, but like these people are actually like just really super awful. And the most feminist person in the story is actually a guy who's like seeing all these things. And so he is able to, you know, draw from his experiences and see how much inequality there is between genders. There's also a lot of inequality between classes. He actually belongs to, which is called the Contour class, which is in charge of economic development and that sort of thing. And there's also a class called Beast Workers, who actually are the people who work inside the beast, or in the guts and in the hearts and doing all this like manual labor. And the characters start to kind of see how their world is made. And like before, they were just kind of accepting, you know, this is how it works. But slowly, like, you know, the curtains are drawn open and they can see all of the injustice that is going on behind the scenes. And they're in the position to decide if they, you know, want to go along with the flow or if they want to do something about this.
So, Mong, your novel is not the traditional immigrant novel. Matter of fact, most of the novel is actually spent in China, and the story is told from the perspective of someone has died, a Chinese immigrant who was a physicist, a woman physicist has died. But we're getting the story after she's died when her daughter goes to China to learn more about the history of her family, because her mother never really told her anything about her history. Matter of fact, a lot of the novel is about Sulan, the character that has died, running from her history, running from her class, running from her background, sort of reinventing herself. But talk a little bit about creating this novel that is a reverse immigrant story, where you see all the things that led up to the character going to America.
Yeah, I wanted to write what I have been calling an immigrant story in negative, because it felt to me like the basis for a lot of immigrant stories that American audiences wanted to hear was sort of a story in which the immigrant doesn't really exist until the moment of arrival, and is sort of defined and made by overcoming obstacles of assimilation. And that story also, you know, I feel like there's like this great appetite in American readers sometimes for a story that affirms their notion of the American dream. And I wanted to turn that on its head. I really wanted to illuminate, you know, the richness and fullness of the first life and the first self of this woman, Sulan. All the suffering of her first life, but also all the joy and the meaning and the beauty of the life that she had before she made the decision to immigrate. And then when she comes to the U.S., the American, what was advertised to her as the American dream is quickly sort of revealed as a sham.
Wow. So Rion, you're the short story writer, and I have a question about the titles. So this is your second collection of short stories. I believe you have 12 or 13 stories in this collection. And the first title of your first collection of short stories was Insurrections.
Yep.
Second title, The World Doesn't Require You. I'm wondering, with titles like that, I don't want to jump to any conclusions about rebellion and protest, but Rion, I'm looking at those titles. So what were the thoughts behind the titles for your two short story collections?
Well, the original title of Insurrections was People in Motion, and my editor didn't think that was a strong title that didn't really reflect what I was doing in the book. Like you said, I write a lot about one of my themes is rebellion. What does that actually mean? What are the actual consequences of that? And I had a story in there called Three Insurrections, which was originally called People in Motion, and I changed it. And so one of the things that my editor suggested was Insurrections, and I thought that's kind of a bold title for a debut short story collection. And so I slapped it on there. The World Doesn't Require You, it's just a phrase that's been always floating around in my mind. I think a lot about, you know, I was listening to an interview on NPR a while ago with a band. It wasn't the type of music that I listened to, and I didn't know the artist, but he had put out a solo album, And we get to the end of the interview, and the interviewer asks a question that it kind of felt like she was wanted to ask the entire interview, and it was kind of like, when are you going to get back with your band? And he said, you know, the world doesn't require that. And I started thinking about all the things that I wanted to happen in my life. I mean, you know, I started with music. I started thinking about, maybe all my life I was kind of sad that Outkast wasn't making good music and the Wu-Tang Clan wasn't making good music. And I said, you know what? I'll just accept the fact that, you know, the fact that they made great music in the past, and the world is just going to keep moving on. And I started thinking about all kinds of other things. It started in music, and I started thinking, if Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder never existed, I would never know it. No one would ever know it, you know? And then it just spread out to all kinds of other things and spread out to everything else in life. And I was just thinking about how, you know, it's sort of a freeing idea to think about, you know, that none of us and that nothing is really essential.
I want to shift gears here because, as we all know, this has been a time of an incredible protest movement here. When I send out the pictures that were taken at the march in Austin, I believe this was last Sunday, my friends who live in other cities are astounded by the number of people that are coming out. I was a child when the civil rights movement occurred. As an adult, this is the greatest protest movement that has ever happened in my lifetime. So I wanted each of the authors to think about how their work or work they have read, how they would interpret that based on the protest movement of today. And I'm going to start with Rion, because Rion wrote a short story about the death of, I believe, Freddie Lee in Baltimore, Maryland, on the occasion of Freddie Lee in his collection, What the world Doesn't Require You. So, Rion, talk a little bit about how you see the protest movement today, how you see your literature, the work you have written about, because you deal directly with a lot of racial issues in your short stories. So give your take on how you see things today from a literary perspective.
Let me make a quick correction. The gentleman in Baltimore who was murdered by the police, his name was Freddie Gray.
Right, I apologize.
And you're right. I did take his. The story was inspired by that moment. Let me ask you a question. I sort of get into that. I feel like at this time, it's important to keep going. I know a lot of writers kind of feel like, you know, what is the necessity of my work right now? What is, you know? But I think this is a powerful Toni Morrison quote saying that this is the time that writers go to work. I think that so many things are connected that we don't even realize that's connected. So we have to keep following our themes and keep following whatever is important to us, even if it doesn't feel directly connected to the moment. But then also we also have to write about the what we're understanding about the moment, because people need that. People need to really. What we do is allowing people to sit back and get an understanding of the emotions of the moment, and that, to me, that is so important. I'm always gonna, you know, write about the themes that I write about. You know, I was if you look at the New York Times bestseller list, you know, the nonfiction list, the top 10 lists are books that sort of deal with themes that about racism, and I think white fragility was number one, and how to be anti-racist was on there. And I looked at my book sales, which are, you know, minuscule in comparison, but there was an uptick. I sold more books since February. You know, it's the highest week since February. When you publish a book, you know that it just continues to go down until you're selling 5 books a week. At least for me. It's back up. And you know, I joke that being a black writer oftentimes feels like you're a war profiteer. Because these moments pop up, and then everyone feels like they have to rush and get a complete understanding right at this moment. And it's, you know, these issues have been going on for before any of our grandfathers and grandmothers were on this earth, and before those and long before their grandparents were on this earth. It's really not a sprint, you know. This is really a marathon, and I really hope that this moment is not that it doesn't just move with the news cycle. I hope this is not just an extended news cycle. When people, particularly white people, read these books, they're realizing that it's gonna take a while, and that this is a continuum.
And I want to go right now to Hmong, because in your book you open up in Tiananmen Square during the great protest movement there in Beijing in June of 1989. So what's your perspective on it?
Yeah. Thanks, Rian, for those words. They really struck home. I think that, you know, Hope, and you and I talked about this a little bit when we had our conversation earlier this year. But when I was writing my book, Little Gods, I had my first draft done, and I just got an agent. And then the 2016 election happened. And I felt sort of paralyzed as an artist for those exact things that you were mentioning, Rian. Just sort of feeling like, what was I doing putting sentences onto a page instead of, you know, trying to do something more directly that could change circumstances in this country. But actually that experience of sort of being slapped in the face by your country really ended up informing the book, because as you mentioned, you know, the book opens on the night of the Tiananmen Square massacre, and that's really a moment where the Chinese people feel not just slapped in the face by their country, but, you know, sort of shot in the chest, I guess. And I went back into the draft and with a sort of more urgent understanding of what it felt like to be heartbroken in this, in not just in sort of like a daily, you know, microaggression way, but in this very like in your face, blunt way. And I've been thinking a lot about, I'm always thinking about, you know, what the role of art is in times of political crisis, but also in general, the role of art in relationship to activism. And of course, those thoughts are even more urgent today than usual. And what's really been striking me recently is just thinking about, when I'm looking at the protests that are happening now, what really sort of fills me with awe is the sense that it's like an expansion of the imagination, right? Now we're talking about ideas like abolishing police and abolishing prisons, which have been around for a long time, but suddenly it's like the public imagination has expanded in order to be able to hold these ideas. And that's really, I guess, what I think that art can do. Is it's sort of like when you read a good book, it's like taking your imagination on a jog, strengthening it and preparing it for times like these. But also it's also like I also want to, you know, emphasize the importance of joy and beauty, right? We can't just like be grieving and suffering all the time because that's what art also does for me, is helps me be able to hold joy and grief at the same time, or an experience of beauty and an experience of suffering, and see that, you know, all of those contribute to the richness of being alive and the preciousness of life.
Richard?
Yeah, this is a great conversation. I think all my work is pretty political, although it hasn't really engaged yet directly with these ideas. In terms of my own background, I'm moved from Texas to Washington, D.C. to get a master's degree. And that's when I went from being like concerned and voting and feeling like I was following what's going on to realizing like, oh my God, I can see the White House from my bus stop. Like I'm stuck waiting for my bus because there's a presidential motorcade going by. Like you just like, you see, like I saw Barney Frank in his like gym shorts return a video to Blockbuster. It's like, oh my God, these are like real people. And I can really like get involved in this career. And I saw protesters, and I was one of them, get pepper sprayed during the 2004 inauguration. And so I went into politics, and I was there for a while. It ended up not being enough for me, partly because, you know, we won. I was there, like I was at, in 2004, I was pepper sprayed. And in 2008, I was at one of the inaugural balls watching Beyonce sing to the Obamas. And then yet 2 years later, the whole country decided, well, actually, we don't like Democrats anymore. And then 2 years after that, the whole country decided, well, we like Democrats again. And then 2 years after that, they said, wait, nope. And everyone went, it got to be so exhausting and feeling like nothing was happening that I threw it all away and moved back to Texas and enrolled in an MFA program and became a high school teacher. Which is a question, is I know a questionable decision. So I think that that experience is there in everything I write, that knowledge of just sort of like seemingly intractable force holding people back. And as someone who believes in the power of protest, it's great to see it start to like inch forward with some change. But like Rian said, you know, maybe this year, you know, maybe it will just be another news cycle. Maybe this year Joe Biden wins West Virginia, Georgia, and Nebraska. And then in 2022, it all goes back the other way again, even worse. But you know, we have to keep trying. We have to keep expanding that imagination.
Nikki?
I agree with all that. I think it's, as a creative person, it's, especially as like a science fiction writer, because like it's my job to think about like, who, you know, what the future is going to hold. And so you can kind of see, you know, the writing on the wall long before like your friends start to see it. And so, you know, wanting to do something about it and having like limited resources is just really frustrating, whether it's money or time, and also balancing, you know, your writing career on top of like all your other obligations. And so for me, I just decided to kind of focus on this one thing, this one way I can help, which is like with kind of developing diversity within like my science and fiction and fantasy community. And so it kind of started few years back. We would have like ArmadilloCon is, you know, my local science fiction and fantasy convention here in Austin. And I love it. I've been going there for a long time, and it's like starting to get really diverse. And like when I first started going, like, you know, 15 years ago, like there were like just maybe a couple Black people. And then we just like always do the head nod whenever we see each other. And like a couple years ago, like I was in a conversation with four other Black women. None of us knew each other, and we were just like talking about geek stuff, and it was just like the most amazing thing that had happened to me. And we were just kind of like, we have panels and stuff, and there were a lot of panels at that time that would deal with, you know, the diversity and lack of diversity in science fiction fandom. And I was kind of like, you know, we keep having these conversations, but like nobody's really doing anything beyond like, you know, that panel. And so like I made a suggestion that, you know, maybe we can offer some like sponsorships for the writing workshop there to bring in writers of color. And they were like, yeah, that's a great idea. Why don't you go ahead and do that? And I'm like, okay. So like that just kind of became like my project to like, you know, bring in other people who had the same vision and like wanted to have the same things. And we've been working on, you know, getting sponsorships for Writer of Color to attend the writer's workshop and to hopefully, you know, build that pipeline so we have a lot of diverse voices like, you know, coming up in the near future.
So I want to start off talking about the experience writing your books. I'm going to start off with the newbies. I'm going to ask Richard and Mon to talk about what that experience was like writing your very first book. And I do want the audience to know that I sort of biased the other two authors. I told them whatever they say about writing the second and third books, it has to be positive. So I'm going to let you know there's some bias going on here. But I'm going to start off with Mon. Talk about that experience writing your very first book, because I know you went through several iterations and you talked a bit about wanting to rewrite it as you developed as a writer. And then after that, Richard, you can jump in at any time. Mon?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, this is my first book. I started writing it before I knew how to write anything because I was really dumb. And I was like, oh, of course I'll start not by, you know, figuring out how to write a short story, but by figuring out how to write the novel that I want to write, which ended up being really hard to write. So it took many years. And each time I got to the end of the draft, I sort of felt like I'd changed and grown as a writer, become a different writer by the end, and would be cringing at the beginning of the draft. So I had to start over again until I was no longer cringing at it. But I think it was, you know, it took maybe 5 or 6 years before I sold it. And during that time, the book felt like my little secret, felt like my secret hiding place. And the strangest thing about having it in the world is that it's not my secret anymore. Anyone can read it. It's not my hiding. I can't go there and hide. So I guess that's what second books are for, because once your first book is out, you need a new secret hiding place.
And Richard, you actually wrote your first book, as you said earlier, in part based on your experience working in politics.
Yeah, I took a political job in Santa Fe. I was there for a year. It's not real. This book isn't based on that experience, but I knew pretty early that I wanted to write about. I didn't want to write about campaigns, but I knew I wanted to like bring in some of that experience and some of that knowledge and some of that, like, some of that ethos into something. And my problem was that I knew I wanted to hit these kind of thematic ideas, and I knew I wanted to like explore these notions, but I didn't really have a sense of, you know, little things like characters and plot and story and if it's interesting. So I spent years and years just spinning my wheels and writing drafts that were like boring. I mean, writing drafts where not much really happened. Writing drafts where I would write about the forests of Santa Fe or this or that, but there wasn't really much of a plot. Despite all evidence to the contrary, I did feel like there was something there. And eventually I felt like I got it into a good spot. You know, God knows how many drafts later, six, seven years. Couldn't get an agent, got lots of like, this is interesting, this is good, but one thing I kept hearing is that people didn't quite know where to place it, which is a classic thing that writers hear. And which I kind of get too. I mean, it's kind of a political novel without politicians. It's kind of a thriller mystery, but not really. There's a skeleton at the beginning, but the identity of the skeleton doesn't really matter. Even when some people try to claim it's one thing, I think all the characters and the readers know that it's not who they claim it is. And, you know, just for me, I eventually became very happy with, you know, giving up. I heard from tons and tons of authors, it seems like more authors than not say, well, I've got that like desk drawer book and it'll stay in there and I needed to write it to get through, you know, whatever. But it's not going to be the one that was out there. And then when Arte Publico won the National Book Critics Circle Lifetime Achievement Award, I was like, oh, let me check them out. I'd known of them, but I didn't know they took uninterested submissions. So I sent it in, and a month later they were like, let's do this. And now it's out there. Although the joke I make is, if you publish a book during quarantine when bookstores are closed, have you really published a book? It's more of an existential question that I don't have an answer to.
I do want to add that your character Charles O'Connell, I do want the audience to know that Richard Santos is not Charles O'Connell, especially considering some of the things he does in the novel. Very questionable things. So I think it is very important that people understand that this novel is not based on your life. It sort of just gave you a framework. So once again, when you start reading, trust me, he is not Charles O'Connell. All right. Nikki, you are the veteran in the group, three books into writing. And this third book just came out, I believe, in October of last year. And I think you've been publishing almost every year since your first book. So talk a bit about the experience of writing Escaping Exodus. And of course, we do want you to be frank. Does it get easier? Is it harder? What are those experiences like? Now, it's not part of a series, so you don't have to worry about keeping up with all the plot lines from the previous novels.
Oh, well, actually, I'm writing the sequel right now. So.
So soon you will have to keep up with all the plot lines.
Yes. It's been an amazing experience overall, I would say. And I definitely encourage people to keep going. I like it to compare getting into the publishing world. My analogy is like jumping onto like a moving treadmill, like that's going full speed. And then like right when you think you've got the hang of it, like they start throwing live sharks at you. And so it's just like you have to deal with so much. And like with your first book, you have, you know, years to get it perfected. You can go through beta readers and, you know, all this stuff. And then you turn in this manuscript, and it's not perfect, but it's like, you know, the best like you can do. And then like when you're on your second book, like you have to like, you know, deal with, you know, going to like conventions and doing panels and stuff on top of like writing and doing interviews, and it just everything compounds. And then your third book, like you're doing copy edits for the second book, and then you're writing the third book, and then you still have to promote the first book. And it's just a lot, but I really love it. And I encourage, even though like through all the headaches, it's just so much fun to be able to like dive into these worlds and you know, put your mark on the world.
All right, Rion, as the short story collector collections, you told me one of your short stories, you took you 2 years to perfect it. Mercury and Retrograde?
That one took me more than 2 years, but some of them in the book took me more than 10 years to perfect.
Wait, take that off the script, please. But go ahead. Talk about that process of writing the second book. And it's different, once again, for those who are listening or watching who want to be short story writers.
Yeah, the first story collection, you know, it a lot of it was about learning the craft. A lot of those stories, I consider them apprentice stories. I was really, you know, taking other people's structures and grafting my own stories onto them, and you know, sort of carefully figuring things out. With the second book, it was really a lot of it was finding my own direction, my own way, and I really think that I really felt like I felt like I had something to prove. I felt like I wanted to prove to myself that I could write a story without borrowing other people's structures, taking a lot of my own concerns that I wasn't sure that I was able to address in the first book. Well, some of the stories in the second book were written before the stories in the first book. I just didn't have the chops to really pull them off. I enjoy having a book out. I always want to be in a state of having a book in the world, which is very difficult now. I'm sort of switching genres. I'm trying to write a novel, and it's just not going to you know, it's not going to get completed as quickly as the second short story. I think there are 3 years between the first book and the second book, and you know, they're going to be more than 3 years because, you know, I have about 6 pages of the novel, and I'm not even sure about those 6 pages. And I've been working on it for a while. But you know, it's fun. It's a process of learning and getting an understanding of who you are. You know, writing a long work is going to really, you're going to go to a lot of different places in your mind that you wouldn't have gone to. So it's a really fun process. I don't know if you heard the screaming baby in the background. So forgive me for that.
Though I am curious because some of our writers have written short stories and have gone to novels. I think Nikki, you've published short stories, right? And Richard, you've published short stories. And Mon, I think all three of you have published short stories. Can you each of you talk a bit about your experience going from writing short stories to writing novels? Anybody jump in anytime? Nobody?
Okay. I actually started writing novels first. I got into writing through National Novel Writing Month, which happens in the month of November, where you write 50,000 word novel. And I'd written probably a couple of novels, and like they're all in the trunk right now. But before I even started writing short stories, so I think it's a really different muscle. I don't think you can like prepare to move up to novels by writing short stories or vice versa. They're just two different storytelling mechanisms, and like you could be good at one and be horrible at the other. So, but definitely try both of them. I would recommend to people.
Yeah, I wrote short stories while I was writing my novel when I sort of got really fatigued with my novel and needed to feel some sense of accomplishment, which I also, you know, I've also had stories that have taken me years and years to write because you know, I put them away for a while, but at least you can get to the end, the feeling of like, oh, I got to the end of a draft a little bit quicker than with a novel. And yeah, I totally agree. It's a very different muscle. Often I know, you know, when you get an idea, you have a sense of its shape and its size and its scope. And with a short story, I feel like there's room to play in both forms. In the short story, you can sort of play, I feel like you can play in a more extreme way for a shorter amount of time. And in the novel, you can play in a more messy way.
Yeah. I've got some short stories out there. I've done some, but they really were, part of it was in an MFA program, it's so much easier to have stories, workshop the novels, so that I definitely fell into that trap a little bit. But I haven't gone back to many of them lately because it's so hard. And short stories are the kind of thing where the more I read them, it's like the more confused I get about how they're made and how they work. Like Rian's collection is so amazing, and it's, you know, when I read a collection like that and I'm like, well, why should I go back and revise this story over here in a way that I don't with novels? Cause I don't know if it's cause I haven't been working on them enough or what, but I haven't gone back to them lately.
I want to let the audience know that we'll be taking your questions through the chat room. So if you have any questions you'd like to ask the authors, please send them through the chat room. And we did get some questions in advance. And the first question, and this is a question that came through the survey that we did prior to today's event with people who had registered. First question was, how can the literary community support you besides the obvious of buying and sharing books? So how can the literary community support you as writers? Or how can the literary community support you? We'll start with Rian.
I mean, a couple ways. I think a lot of people feel shy about promoting their work, but I would say that find ways to get your work promoted, because it supports me when I read good books and I find out about good books and I would say a lot of us have other work that we write, essays, short stories. Social media is really powerful. Share that stuff, and that brings other people to your to the work. When let people know about if you read, let's say you read Richard's book and you love it, tell someone about it. That's how these ideas get shared.
That's a great idea, Rian. I like that. Everyone do that idea, that last one.
The other thing I want to say, I want to piggyback on what Richard had said, going back to what he said about looking at short stories and having less and less an understanding of. That's exactly how I feel about novels. I feel like I can understand short stories intuitively, but a novel, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Anybody else want to weigh in on what the literary community can do to support you, Nikki or Mong?
Yeah.
Or Richard? Wait. All right, there's a battle here. Oh, go ahead, Nikki.
I would say also to request from libraries. Like a lot of authors get like a large chunk of their writing income from libraries that buy their books. And also, if you have friends who like pirate books, tell them not to do that, because that just kind of hurts, people who are trying to get stories out. And also, just give books, leave reviews whenever you can, leave a review wherever you can leave one. And support reviewers, turn into their feeds and stuff, and give them support also, because they're getting our books out there.
Yeah, I would also add that just being here, being in the audience now is a huge part of that. There are so many events happening right now on Zoom, and join them, right? And like, there've been a few that I've signed up for and they've started and I'm like, oh, it already started. I don't want to get on late. And then I think that's stupid. I'm not talking, I'm just listening. If I miss the first 10 minutes, I could still get something great out of the last 10 minutes. And that really makes a difference. But really spreading the word, spreading the word about getting great books out there, especially ones that aren't from the big presses, especially ones that aren't bestsellers. We don't need to know about those because everybody knows about those. But like me as a National Book Critics Circle board member, there are books out there that like those publishers aren't reaching out to us because they don't have time, because they're independent, because their authors are independent. So like find people, tell them about their books.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. The one thing I'll add is that I've been thinking a lot recently about like reflecting on my own education and how I didn't read Toni Morrison until I was 25 because I feel like my formal education failed me. And so not just like supporting bookstores and libraries, but if you have children or if you're in school, really looking at trying to push for writers that you feel represent you and you feel that everyone should read, for those books to be on syllabuses and in classrooms, not just like in perhaps like an Asian American studies program or an African American studies program, but for like these books to be in survey classes, because I feel like there would be more of like a broad appetite for interesting books by authors of color if people are if everyone is reading, great examples of those works all the time, from the time they're a child, through their formal education.
I think one of the interesting things as a radio talk show host is one of the things I've tried to start doing is coupling interviews with major writers who everyone knows, New York Times bestselling writers, because we know that always tends to draw the attention of the masses. So trying to couple them on my shows with a rising a rising writer, somebody who has not gotten the same type of publicity as the New York Times bestselling writer. So I think that's one of the things that I've seen from a radio show host perspective that could probably work to help to bring along writers who aren't that well known. The other thing I would strongly recommend is for those of you on social media, if there is an author you're reading that you like, literary community, if you like the author, let the whole world know through social media, tweet it out. One of the things I have found is that among the genre groups, like say for crime fiction, a lot of those writers support each other an incredible amount, and they will retweet, like. And so there's a whole world out there where one person will write a book, a person will like it, they'll tweet about it, and the next thing you know, it's gotten 50 retweets. So if you're a fan of the work of these writers, please be sure to publicly let the world know on your Facebook page, on Twitter, on Instagram. Let the world know that you're a fan of your writers, and encourage your friends and the people that are friending you on Facebook and Twitter, encouraging them to take a look at these books, because as you've already know, the New York Times bestselling authors, and I do read some of them, they don't need any help promoting their books, but we certainly want to promote the books of the writers here. And we're starting to get some questions in. Let's see. I do believe Charlotte here is going to be gathering some of those questions for us that are coming in through the Zoom group chat. Just drop me a text, Charlotte, whenever you're ready to start bringing those questions to the audience but I'm going to go to another question that came out of the survey. And this one, what are the easy... Go ahead, Charlotte.
Oh, no. Ignore me.
Okay. So I'll take another one we did get in advance. What are the eases or challenges publishing as an author of color? And that was the question that we got in the survey. Ease or challenges publishing as an author of color? All right, we'll go on to the next question. Okay. What is your...
We can talk about that question. It's just such
a... Go right ahead. I'm waiting for you to ask it. Yeah. Go ahead, Richard. Rion. There you go, Rion.
I think, I guess some of the... I mean, I haven't faced a lot of the obstacles that I hear about a lot. If you look on Twitter recently, there's been a discussion on payment, and a lot of people are tweeting their advances, and you know it's kind of ridiculous. You see Jesmyn Ward talking about struggling to get a decent advance even after winning the National Book Award. We see some of Roxane Gay's advances, and you're like, what? You know, she's a proven commodity. And you know, I often say that, you know, survey after survey has shown that Black women read the most number of books. Well, how come Black women are not the most highly paid and most highly promoted people out there? So I think those are some challenges. You know, trying to get the, you know, what you're worth is a huge challenge for a writer of color.
Anybody else would like to add to that?
Yeah, I can add to that. I definitely think that the publishing world is very, 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 very white, and there's an assumption within the marketing and sales teams in particular that the biggest chunk of money that's going to come in is from white women readers. And often, you know, editors are reading with that in mind when they're looking to acquire. And also that comes into play when they're marketing and designing and packaging your book. So, like, I mean, I think you hear about these stories all the time, and I was almost surprised that it happened to me. But, you know, I at one point I was pressured to put an Asian woman's face on my cover. And luckily I had a great agent and an editor who supported. It wasn't my editor, actually, who wanted this. It was someone else on the outside. But yeah, just these little things where most of the people who are working on your book, on promoting it, on presenting it to the world, are white, and they're thinking about an audience that's mostly white. That's definitely a challenge in the publishing industry, as it is in most other industries.
Yeah, I might just to continue what Manga's saying there, that it's, and this is something I'm learning through several of the organizations that I'm part of, but it's very similar to the protests happening now. It's not a question of, do you think that every police officer is racist? Right? It's not a question of, do you think that every white publisher or critic in New York is racist? And it's not that simple. And like has been said, that these large structural like elements of society, they move slowly, and they're full of lots of people who are thinking about the bottom line in publishing, that are used to just how things have gotten done. And so that's how you have people who think that they're aware and well-meaning make really foolish decisions because they're so sort of blind that's what structural racism is. You can't see it. It would be really easy if cops or publishers showed up with Klan hoods on. People would just be like, let's get rid of that person. But it doesn't work that way. And so I think that any of the challenges that authors of color face, they're the challenges that people of color face in all parts of society. And so stuff like this, these protests or anything else, it's not just addressing policing. The American Dirt controversy from a few months ago wasn't just about publishing. It spreads out to everything. That's why it's valuable.
So I will make a comment because I go to a fair amount of book authors panels, discussions, and those sorts of things. One of the things I found curious a while back was there is this notion, there was this notion that some of the authors were sort of complaining that because there have been some new imprints started where imprints of publishing houses are actually looking for minority authors. I was surprised at how a few of the authors, and at least one, felt like, wow, I can't get my work published, and now they're developing imprints for minority authors. And I will say this, that the reality is that minority authors have not been having access to opportunities for a very, very long time. I have a talk show, African Americans, and I will tell you that most of the books sent to me, the vast majority of the books sent to me by publicists are not of authors of color. So while there have been some efforts to sort of open the door, to me it's like authors of color have been, generally speaking, and there's always outliers or exceptions, right? There's always an exception or outlier that people love to point to, that exception or that outlier, that LeBron James of authors. But the reality is, in my experience of doing the radio show for 11 years, the vast majority of authors that are promoted and pushed have been white authors. And so that's what I've seen as a book show host. And that has always been the case, even though now there's a little bit more happening. So I'm going to go ahead and jump into some of the questions that we have here. And we do have plenty of time here. Let's see. I think the first question I got at 11:06 a.m. So I'm going in order here on the chat line. In Austin, what writing groups do you recommend because you've participated in them? or anywhere really since they're online. So what writing groups, for those of you, the two writers we have here in the Austin area, Richard Santos and Nikki, and just in general with Ma and Rion, since a lot of writing groups now are online. So what writing groups would you, have you participated in, if you've participated in any, and who do you recommend? So jump in, anybody at any time. Nikki?
Okay. Well, if you are interested in writing science fiction and fantasy, I would recommend Slug Tribe. And they were meeting in person, but now they're meeting virtually. So I guess if you're anywhere, you could reach them. But that's focused on science fiction and fantasy. I think it's slugtribe.org. If not, just do a Google search. And also Armadillo Writers Workshop. Whenever, it's probably not going to happen this year. I don't know, maybe it will. But that's a good place to go to get feedback on your manuscript and also to make those connections that you will need, and we pretend aren't important, but are important as you progress in your career.
No, Rion?
You know, the Chameleo Writing Workshop was a very pivotal kind of a turning point in my writing life. It's a workshop for Black writers. Again, it's something that's not going to happen this year. But when it returns, I think it's worth applying to. It's subsidized, so the cost is very cheap. The first year I went, it was free, and they stopped doing that. But it's relatively cheap. You know, the other thing I would say is that, you know, I haven't been a part of a lot of writing groups. But one thing that's been useful to me when I was coming up was Twitter. You know, social media, you know, probably destroying our democracy, but it really did help find other writers to connect with. And you know, I made friendships that were pivotal, you know, to me. But also, you know, it became, you know, I've made actual friendships, you know, based on that I wouldn't have made otherwise, you know, based on distance or whatever. And that's been helpful. People, you know, I've traded work with people that I've met on Twitter. So I would suggest that.
Yeah. I would say that writing groups are really hard. This is the value of MFA programs, if there is one. It's just that you have regular meetings with people and you get to know their stuff. So, but that's out of reach for almost everybody. So any sort of writing group where there are regular participants and regular meetings, you're going to get something out of, even if it's just like a bunch of amateurs. That's great. That's fine. There are organizations like the Writers Center in the DC region, or the Writers League of Texas, Austin Batcave here in Austin, who have more regular classes, like, you know, led by published authors. And that's good too. But if you can't afford those, just finding anybody that can regularly read your work and you'll read theirs. That's not like a family member. That's really valuable.
And Mon, are you part of any groups?
Yeah, Kundiman was very important to me. Kundiman is a organization for Asian American poets and fiction writers. And there are, you know, there's Kaveh Kanem for African American poets, and Canto Mundo, I believe, and of course Chameleo, which Rion mentioned. There are all these groups that are sort of, I feel like, rising up in the cracks of the, you know, the gaps of formal education, and that have been really useful for me. VONA is one that I've heard of for writers of color, but I haven't actually done myself. I don't know if any of you have done it. You can speak to it. And yeah, just agree with Richard's point that you can make your own little writing group with, you know, two or three people, and that can sustain you while you're working away.
Another question we have in the chat room: did you all complete MFA programs? Should that be the basic foundation for successful novel writing?
Second part of that question, no, it does not necessarily need to be a successful part. It's not a necessity. There are plenty of writers who have not done an MFA program. Now, first part of the question, yeah, I completed an MFA program. It was a very good experience emotionally, and it did help me with my work. I learned a lot. But yeah, there's this other part of it where it's financially, I took out a lot of loans, and it was very, very costly. So I would suggest there are a lot of MFA programs that are free, you have fellowships and scholarships to attend. The program I teach in University of Maryland, we let in very few people a year. This year we let in six people, but they all have tuition remission. And so I would suggest only doing a program if you're getting it paid for. Because those student loans, they multiply. I'm probably gonna be paying it off and for many, many years.
I will say that one misconception I get a lot when I'm talking to writers is that I feel like sometimes and Lulu, who asked this question, I'm not saying this is where you're coming from, but I think some people ask the MFA question because they're under the impression that it's like a pipeline to agents and producers and Hollywood and million-dollar book deals, and it's really not. And if you're looking to break into the literary community, start local, volunteer with your local literacy and literary organizations, because there'll be huge overlap, go to the book festivals, email Hopeton all the time, get on Twitter. Just be part of the community, and that's how you make connections. That's how you review books on your blog, and then eventually, review them for Kirkus, and then review them for whoever else. That's another way into the community.
Go ahead, Rio.
It's definitely not a pipeline. I think there are very few programs that will do that for you. And even those programs, it's just not a guarantee that someone is going to look at you and say, "Oh, he's an MFA, I will publish him." That's just not how it works at all.
Nikki or Mon, do either one of you go the MFA route?
Talk about it. I think there's. I didn't get an MFA. Like I said, I just started writing through National Novel Writing Month. But I think there is like people kind of see the end result of, they think it's like a sudden, sudden success for people who get their novels published. And in reality, they've been working on their writing and working on their craft for years and years and years and years. And so like these sudden successes, I think are kind of confusing people maybe. I had written, I don't know, probably 10 years before I got an agent. And I got her just like cold querying. So it's a long process and you have to have patience for most of us. Some of us, it happens faster, but a lot of those overnight success stories are not overnight success stories.
Yeah, I got an MFA because I had no idea how to become a writer. And it seemed like one option that was available. And, it was good for me. It did open a lot of doors. I did make connections. I did meet my agent through my MFA. But I do think that is, I'm the out of my class of 12 students that the agent visited, I think I'm the only one who ended up signing with her. So like, it's definitely not a pipeline. And there's so many other ways. There's no rules for writing, for how to become a successful writer. You just have to, like Nikki said, you just have to do the work, And some of the work is finding a way to make those connections, but there are a lot of other avenues, as Richard mentioned. There's also, you know, conferences you know, other sort of like workshops, independent workshops that give you opportunities to meet agents and editors and interact with the publishing world.
I have a real quick question for Rian. One of the questions in the chat room was they wanted to know the source of the survey for Black women being big readers.
I wish I could remember. There was a survey that was done many not many years ago, about five years ago. And I don't remember the name. It was a big survey on reading, and I need to look that up. I'll look that up and get that answer.
Nikki, we had a question directly from you, and I'm going to read the question directly from the survey we did. And for those of you who are asking what survey, if you registered through Eventbrite, I asked everyone to go to SurveyMonkey. We did a survey to gather some information on the people registered. We also asked if you had any questions. So these are questions that came from the survey. If white authors get to write grand fantasy or sci-fi adventures whose focus is not representation, why can't minorities do the same if they choose to, and how to fight against the expectation that you only write for your minority experience? For the past few years, literary agents I pitched to in person have suggested I instead write stories that deal with my Latinx experience, which makes me feel like they value my representation more than my writing abilities. And I actually kind of put Nikki in there first because they asked about grand fantasy and sci-fi adventures, but I want to open this up to anybody. But I'll start with you, Nikki.
Okay. I would say that that person's perceptions are probably 100% on, that those agents do value your representation more than your writing. And it's just a really problematic thing that's going on. And there's a lot of gatekeeping. We talked about, you know, how white publishing is, and they want a very specific narrow narrative that they can, you know, pitch and sell. And also, like, I don't think really people talk about this, but like, they are also selling you. And if they see, you know, a person of color that is, you know, tick certain boxes for, you know, certain aesthetics or whatever, how they want to appear. So it is a really big problem, and it's something that we just need to call out and continue to push back on. Your story is going to be your story, no matter, you know, what story you're telling. Your experiences and voice are going to form that story. So it, you know, it shouldn't matter what you're writing about, because like all of those elements are still going to be there. And it's just, yeah, it's really frustrating. And there has been kind of a push for people to be able to tell what stories they want to tell. But, you know, publishing is still kind of catching up to that.
Go ahead, Rian.
Oh, I was going to say I found the survey. It's a Pew Research survey. Were you calling on me to answer the question?
Yes. did you hear the question?
I did not hear the question. I was looking for the survey. Pew Research survey, 2014, 2019. They had those data points about Black women readers. But what was the question?
The question was whether or not that often publishers are looking for minorities only to write about the minority experience. But the person who posed the question said they want the opportunity to write about from any narrative or perspective they want to, and they want to be selected based on their writing ability, not simply because they're Latinx, as she wrote in her question.
Yeah, you know, that goes back to that original question, the earlier question about what people face. I think there is often an assumption that because you have a certain background, you're writing about a particular experience. And of course, anybody can write about anything they want. Everyone should write about whatever they're interested in, whatever they're passionate about, whatever they're thinking about. And I think, unfortunately, for writers of color, that means a more difficult time finding the right agent who's going to pitch that book to the right editor. I think there's a history. You know, of course, there's a long history of people writing about whatever they want to write about. But it's about finding the right people who are going to champion that.
I would also add that, yeah, this is a real issue, but also you can't let it affect what you're writing today. You know, if it's affecting what you're writing today, then they've already won and you've already lost.
Yeah, I just want to add to that and say, like, I know it's hard when you're a writer starting out looking, you know, trying to get attention from an agent, but really, if you can try to reframe it and think of it as that agent showed you that they were not the right agent for you, if they gave you that comment, and they're going to misrepresent your work. So they did you a favor by showing you their cards. And you just have to find the agent who's, like Rian said, going to represent you. And just want to add to, you know, all the voices encouraging the question asker to keep writing the work that they want to write. An Alice Walker quote is always in the back of my head, you know, we are the ones we've been waiting for. You just have to do the work that you want to do and, you know, hope that the world will catch up to you. And I think, you know, slowly it is.
And we did have Charlotte in the chat said, Percival Everett's novel Erasure addresses the issue of representation in publishing. Charlotte Gullick, who is the chair of the creative writing department at Austin Community College. Charlotte, do you mind just sharing it with us a little bit about that novel?
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity. It is about a professor who he writes outside the expectations of what a Black writer should be writing about. And he keeps being told he needs to write more Black. And he kind of doubled down on that, and then some really interesting things ensue. And it just, for folks who are trying to, you know, write what they want to write and not write in that narrow lane of what the dominant culture says you should be writing. It's a harsh book, but it's also very inspirational. And if you don't know Percival Everett's work, his ability to end a book is pretty amazing. So it'll fire you up and kind of give voice to some of that emotion that you might be feeling. And he's just a really fine writer.
And there's another writer that addresses that issue, but in a different way. Elizabeth Nunez, who has published several books with Akashic Publishing out of Brooklyn, New York. In her book, Not for Everyday Use, the main character works for a publishing company, and she works for an imprint. And one of her battles with the imprint is not for them to publish work by Black authors, but the type of books that they want to publish by Black authors. And in the novel, she's concerned about their desire to sort of narrowly classify the kind of books that they want to publish about Black authors instead of being open to a broad array of books written by Black authors and not just thinking of those authors as only writing one type of book. All right. I do want to ask this question as I pull up my notes here, if you give me a minute here. All right. My iPad would freeze on me when I'm getting ready to go back to the questions here, right? But I think one of the things as I've interviewed authors during this this COVID-19, I've interviewed several authors who have told me that they have actually struggled to focus and actually write during COVID-19, that it actually presented a challenge for them because of their anxiety and stress from what was going on in the world today. And by the way, I was getting these comments before the protest movements really took off. So my question for all the for Richard, Nikki, Mon, and Rian, has being sheltering in place and COVID-19 affected your productivity and your ability to focus as a writer?
I can talk about that a little bit. I mean, definitely, short answer is yes. Long answer includes the fact that I also have an almost 12-month-old baby, and that's its own sort of distraction. I haven't gone back to my novels in progress, but I have found success with some book reviews and some personal essay type stuff, and just going far afield of what I normally do. Like, there was I read an article about how HBO is going to make a Hellraiser TV show. And I was like, you know, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to write myself an episode of a Hellraiser TV show that nobody wants me to do, no one will ever see. And I did, and it was nice, and it filled a couple of days, and it made me feel like I did something. So I've had some success just going far away from what I usually do.
I've been very up and down. You know, I was writing a short story, and I wrote it very quickly, and I think it's good. and I don't usually write like that, but I wrote with you know, intentionality, and I got that achieved. But then afterwards, I had a very hard time getting everything together. My novel projects are just sort of, you know, just floating out there. I'm having a hard time concentrating on that. But that was before the COVID-19, so I can't really blame it. One thing I have been having a difficulty with, you know, I had been having a difficulty with was reading. You know, I would read and I would have a problem with comprehension that I never had before. I found the solution to that is, I don't know why I ever stopped taking notes in my books while I was writing, but I returned to that because I had to focus a lot harder, and I think that was a lot that had a lot to do with the anxiety surrounding COVID-19.
Mong.
For me, it actually in the beginning, I was very productive because I had a whole book tour planned that was canceled, so suddenly I had all this time that, you know, I didn't have to be thinking about publicly presenting myself, and I could just hide away in my next project. But recently it's been a little harder because the world demands to be looked at right now. And sometimes it's hard to look at what's going on and feel the peace and like stillness that I need to write. One thing that I've been trying to do lately is just, you know, carve out some hours where I start writing before I log on, before I go on the internet, and read the news, almost sort of treating writing practice as like a meditation practice. But also, you know, I think it's okay to not write sometimes. You know, as writers, you're writing when you're not writing. You're writing when you're living, when you're looking. One example that I think about a lot is one of my favorite poets, Louise Glück, spent like years reading only gardening magazines. and she thought, she sort of was worried that she would never write a poem again. And then she wrote a beautiful collection of poetry, The Wild Iris, which ended up winning, I forgot which award, one of the fancy awards. So it's okay. I think it's okay if you're not writing. Just, you can be writing while you're not writing.
Nikki?
My publication date has gotten pushed back twice now. I've been trying to get edits done. The first round of edits I got back were like right as quarantine was hitting. And I was like, I need some extra time for that. And then the second round of edits I got back hit like right as, you know, protests were starting up. And I'm like, I still need some more time. And just like, it just, you know, I want, you know, to be focused on different things. And it's just hard to focus. But on the other hand, I did. One morning I woke up with a short story in my head, and I woke up at 5, was done with the short story around 8:30, and it was like kind of dealing with post-apocalyptic, like what life will look after, you know, this virus, and it just was kind of cathartic to get that story out, and so quickly. So it's kind of like, it's been up and down, but definitely has been affecting me.
We did have one other recommendation for a novel from Dexter Palmer's excellent novel, Version Control, also touches on this less on the publishing side, but more on writing teachers expecting Black authors to write about racism. I highly recommend it. Now we have another author online, Ruben DeGallo. I apologize, Ruben. Ruben is a YA writer, and he is wondering, what are the authors reading?
I'm reading Camus' The Plague, which is interesting because it's it's about a pandemic, so many of the steps along in the book are steps along the way that we have gone through. So that's what I'm reading right now. One of the things I'm reading right now.
Mong?
I've actually been reading a lot of nonfiction. I just got off a Susan Sontag spree. Right now I'm reading Asata Shakur's autobiography. And I'm also rereading Teresa Cha's Dictée, which is a unclassifiable book of poetry and memoir.
Nikki?
Okay. I read Pet. I don't know the author's name, sorry. And I probably should have looked it up. I'm just kind of juggling books right now and haven't settled into one in particular, but it's written. And I read Check Please recently too, which is a hockey graphic novel. My reading has kind of been all over the place lately.
So Mom, what's the name of the author of Pet?
Oh, I'm not sure if I can pronounce it correctly, but Akweke Emezi.
Akweke Emezi, we believe, is the author of Pet. We have another question that came in earlier, and we only have, we have about 10 minutes left, so I'm going to ask the authors to think of this as a round robin here. What is your personal revision process like? And we'll start with you, Nikki.
Typically my first draft is like a fast draft that I don't put a lot of research into. So like all of my research goes in on the second draft. And so on the revision, I like to get to know the characters better. I have this book called The New Astrology by Suzanne White, and it combines Eastern and Western horoscopes into like 144 combinations of different horoscopes, and it's a really easy way to get kind of a character sketch without putting a lot of work into it, because they list out all these different personality types. And so I go and give all of my characters a birthday, and then that'll fit within the range of their character type. Just draw a lot of maps. I like to draw like a floor plan of the house they live in, streets they live on. And just get a like really good visualization in my own head, because I think even though it might not come out on the page, like the reader can really tell when you put in that effort.
Richard?
Yeah, I need to do a deep revision of my second book, and my plan is to print it out and retype it and leave a lot of it behind.
All right, Mung?
I'm a big fan of retyping things, retyping new drafts, because I like my writing to feel alive. And sometimes when you've been working on something for a really long time, it feels very dead to you. And retyping it can help you bring a new energy and make revisions clear, whether when you're in the middle of retyping something, it suddenly becomes clear that that next sentence doesn't matter and you can just leave it behind and go somewhere else. So I'm a big fan of that as a revision strategy.
Rian.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of baking in revision to the process. Like for instance, I might write a short story. The last short story I wrote it out by hand so that when I type it up on the computer, I naturally have to revise, make me question every sentence. And usually when I open a file, I read it from the beginning and I go through sentence by sentence. And then I start writing new stuff. So revision is kind of part, is actually along the way. I don't necessarily have first drafts and second drafts. Kind of do, but kind of don't.
We did have another question for you, actually, that came with the survey completed yesterday. How did you decide on the order of your stories, Rian?
Both times it was sort of a collaboration between my editor and myself, but both times I had the first and last story set. And that's when I know I have a collection, is when I have the first and last stories. With this one, the second one, it ends with a novella that's like 150 pages. there's nowhere else to put that but the end. And originally it was supposed to be in the middle, but it just got too long to be at the end. Here's my thinking, right? You have to have a beginning that just knocks people out, that gets people to stop and like, I want to keep reading. And then you have to have an ending that echoes in the reader's head. In between, it's kind of a toss up. But I think also I have to really think about how the stories play together, what themes are recurrent. I think about length. So it's a lot about rhythm.
I'll just add one thing about revision that I just thought of. For those of you who are struggling to revise, there's a function on, if you have a Mac, you can get your, if you go into accessibility settings, you can get your computer to read your manuscript to you, which is also very helpful when you've stared at it for a million years and it just looks like blah on the page.
That reminds me of a part of my process, revision process, is often reading out loud. And it's the process that it's the part that I hate the most, but it's very crucial because things sound all right in your head, but then when you hear it out loud, that doesn't sound right at all.
Why do you hate that part?
It's boring.
Get your computer to do it for you. That robot voice.
I don't think that would change it.
All right, last question. What is the best writing advice you've ever received? And we'll start with Nikki.
I would say just keep writing. Like, nothing else matters. Just, tell your story.
Richard?
When at Texas State, I got to work with Tim O'Brien, and he read a chapter of my book that I really thought set up the characters, provided real personality, detailed some like important information of the plot. And he had a lot of notes, but the only one I remember was, all that happens in this chapter is coffee. And so I keep in mind, stuff has to happen. Characters can't just be like downloading information back and forth. Personality isn't enough. Stuff has to move.
Mong?
I think, something along the lines of the Alice Walker quote I mentioned earlier, that you should write the book that you want to read, and that's it. Don't think about anyone else.
And Rian.
For me, it's read a poem every day. That makes your prose more fluid.
So once again, our guests today have been Rian Amilcar-Scott, author of The World Doesn't Require You, Richard Z. Santos, author of Trust Me, Nikki Drayden, author of Escaping Exodus, Mong Jen, author of Little Gods. I'm going to ask each of you once again, plug your local bookstore where you would like people to purchase your book. And I'm looking at the screen here that I've put up. So we'll start in the bottom right-hand corner. Nikki, where should they buy Escaping Exodus?
You can get Escaping Exodus from Book People.
All right. And Mong Jen, Little Gods?
I'll say, you can get Little Gods from, I would say just get it from your independent bookstore. Because a lot of the local bookstores here aren't shipping
very far. So get it from your independent bookstore that you love.
All right, Rion.
Mahogany Books, and I'll also add Sankofa. You can go either one of those. Those are both in D.C. I don't know if Sankofa ships. Mahogany certainly does.
And Richard.
Anywhere, but Bookwoman in Austin has signed copies.
All righty. And once again, I do want to thank our sponsors, the City of Austin, Cultural Arts Division of the Economic Development Department, HEB, Capital Metro, Austin Community College, and Velvet Price. Don't kill me. I should have something here from Velvet Price, District Clerk, but I'm sure she will forgive me. I also want to thank Austin Community College once again, Charlotte Gullett and Daryl Medweather for their support with this event. But most importantly, let's give, and everyone turn on your mics here, and let's give a rousing round of applause to Nikki Drade and Richard Santos, Mong Jen, and Rion Scott. I want to hear